Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. During the year, we've devoted much attention to the growing power of China, from its new weapons to its confrontation with the U.S. in the South China Sea. But as we recently saw, China's global economic power is also growing. At the end of November, the International Monetary Fund added China's currency, the renminbi, to a select group of world reserve currencies, joining the dollar, the euro, and the pound. In addition to the added prestige, reserve currency status means that more companies will use the renminbi, increasing the currency's liquidity and providing Chinese companies with easier access to capital. China enters the world reserve currency club with a strong hand. China's huge trade surpluses have enabled China to accumulate the world's largest foreign exchange reserves with $3.5 trillion worth of dollars, euros, and other currencies. This is important as it provides China with the ability to intervene in world currency markets to protect the renminbi's value should it be threatened. China's growing economic influence is also demonstrated by the strong support shown for its new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, with key U.S. allies Germany, Britain, South Korea, and Australia joining the bank, leaving only the U.S. and Japan on the sidelines. The new bank promises to be a rival to the U.S.-dominated World Bank, whose work in Asia has been disappointing. As a complement to the new bank, China is rolling out the One Belt, One Road program for the construction of a network of roads, rails, and pipelines along the old Silk Route route through Central Asia to Europe. A maritime equivalent calls for new port facilities from Southeast Asia to East Africa to the Mediterranean. Marshawn, is there any precedent in China's history for such a strong international presence?
Not really, but then we have to remember that China underwent really a rude introduction to the world in the 19th century. China is one of the oldest civilizations in the world and one of the oldest continuous states in the world. China as a state came into existence around 300 BC with the state of Qin uniting all the nations of all the states of China under the first emperor Qin Shihuangdi. The first emperor sought to conquer the world, but to him the world was China. It was the Chinese states. And one of the things is that you see develop in the Chinese mentality is China as the center of the world. The Manchus, this was really epitomized, the Manchus in the 19th century, where they said that China was the civilized world. All other peoples were barbarians. And that's why they never understood the concept of ambassadors, because ambassadors, they believed, were people who came to pay tribute to you. In the Western idea, the ambassador was somebody who came to, you know, hold negotiations, to reach trade agreements and whatnot. To the Chinese, the ambassador was somebody who came to offer tribute. And when the Westerners in the 19th century showed up and said, we're not here to offer tribute, the Chinese were a little bewildered because they're like, you're the barbarians, you're beneath us. But this is also what led to the disasters of the Opium Wars in the 1840s, 1850s, and so forth, and then the eventual destruction of the Chinese Manchu dynasty after the Boxer Rebellion in 1900, was China's absolute unwillingness to realize that the West was not this distant, barbaric, backwards entity, but was actually moving forward, was actually advanced technologically and a real threat. So the Chinese and the Boxer Rebellion in particular were coming at Western machine guns, Maxim machine guns and Mauser rifles and Lee Enfields, attacking them with spears and swords. So this demonstrated China's departure from the rest of the world. Now, granted, there was the Mongol Empire, which dominated China, and really Genghis Khan became culturally Chinese. He learned Chinese. His Mongol culture absorbed Chinese culture and in a sense became Chinese, and he had a global empire. But it wasn't a Chinese empire, it was still a Mongol empire, even though it was very culturally Chinese. It wasn't until the defeat of China in the Opium Wars and then the eventual collapse of the Manchu dynasty on October 10th, 1911, after the Boxer Rebellion and China being divvied up by the West, that China suddenly realized that they had really failed to keep up with the times, that the rest of the world were barbarians, but were barbarians that could reckon with them. The Chinese, I don't think, ever really forgave the West for that, because you have to remember that China was not only divided between the Western powers, to include the United States, Russia, Great Britain, France, and Germany, and Japan, too, but this also led to civil war. And this civil war lasted for almost 38 years. From 1911 all the way up to 1949, China was virtually in perpetual state of civil war. The Chinese have a 3,000-year memory. So for us, events like World War II are really ancient history. To the Chinese, they're not. To the Chinese, the Boxer Rebellion's fairly recent history, I mean, relative to 3,000 years of civilization. And to a great extent, I don't think they ever forgave the West for what had happened, for the destruction of the Manchu dynasty, and ultimately for the civil war, the 38 years of civil war that followed. So I think what a lot of this is a lot of this is sort of a way for China to guarantee it will not be supplanted by the West again. It realized that it tried to isolate itself from the West for protection. That didn't work. So it's that, almost that philosophy of, if you can't beat them, join them. They're going to become better at it. And we did see a certain phenomena like this in Japan after the Meiji Restoration, when the Japanese decided, we're going to beat the West at their own game, really is what we're starting to see in China. China, now that it has really emerged from the years of Mao to a modern military and economic superpower, it seems their strategy is to beat the West at its own game economically and militarily.
The West, as it expanded, sought to take over countries through sometimes direct colonial rule, sometimes by toppling governments and putting in surrogates. Does China expand in that manner, or does China have a different technique?
China seems to have a different technique. It's interesting because they're a communist, atheistic state. They're not ideologues. They will do business with Islamic fundamentalists in places like Sudan, where they sell a tremendous amount of arms. And then at the same time, they'll sell arms to countries like Pakistan. And then they'll sell arms to a country like Zimbabwe, actually. The Chinese currency now is becoming more and more increasingly used in Zimbabwe. After the Zimbabwean dollar collapsed, they were using the U.S. dollar for the longest time. Now Zimbabwe is becoming awash with Chinese currency.
Do they have a different policy, for example, in the Pacific regarding their Asian neighbors than they have, let's say, towards the Middle East or Africa or Europe?
A little bit, yes. I think they tend to view their Asian neighbors with a little bit more hostility and distrust. Again, I think they know that they can put the screws to Zimbabwe, because if Zimbabwe starts using the renminbi, the Chinese can shut down the Zimbabwean economy overnight. But they can't hold that over Japan. They can't hold that over South Korea. And Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, these are U.S. surrogates. They're not only propped up in the way we might prop up Egypt, they are really our staunchest allies in Asia, and ergo China's biggest threat. But also, let's not forget, Japan in particular was an occupier of China. During the 1920s and 30s, they were the dominant force controlling China at one point, and they waged a brutal war. I mean, let's not forget the rape of Nanking. And this is something that's still fresh in the minds of Chinese. I think their approach to Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, takes on a much more aggressive tone. And even their approach to Vietnam takes on a much more aggressive tone than it does countries in the Middle East, or certainly countries in Africa, where they know if we give them arms and currency, we can edge out the Americans, because they know that's been the game of the West, to dominate these countries. Colonialism ended, but there's still a control kept over these countries through their corrupt governments. And this is the power of currency and the power of arms. And the Chinese know they can play that game against the U.S. in places like the Middle East and in places like Africa, but it doesn't work as well in places like Asia.
In the past, of course, we've discussed China's military innovations in recent years as they try to bring their military up to the standards of the West, and perhaps they're even going to exceed the West, which brings to mind the recent article I read on the B-52 bomber, which still dominates the U.S. Air Force fleet, even though it made its maiden flight back in April of 1952. The B-52 bomber was designed for carrying nuclear bombs during the Cold War. It was scheduled for retirement years ago. But unfortunately, it's expected to keep flying until at least 2040 because its replacement hasn't even been designed yet. What does this suggest about the state of the U.S. military vis-a-vis China?
Well, part of the problem is, as the old adage goes, the U.S. military is always prepared to fight the last war. What we have been fighting are more or less wars akin to the colonial wars of the 19th century. And I'm not calling Afghanistan or Iraq colonial conflicts, so let's be very clear there. But in terms of in the style, you know, in the nature of the war, we are fighting an enemy that is a guerrilla insurgent force, much as the British faced in places like South Africa, faced in places like Egypt, in Afghanistan. You know, we're experiencing these same kind of conflicts, insurgent-type conflicts. And when we do fight a more or less conventional army, like we did Saddam Hussein, it's an army that fundamentally really is not on par with ours. Technologically, militarily, in terms of training and leadership, is not on par with ours. As a result, the Iraqis never stood a chance in terms of shooting down our B-52s. It just was not going to happen. So there wasn't really this impetus to advance a lot of our more conventional hardware. That's why we still have aircraft carriers that were built in the 1960s. That's why we have the B-52 fleet, which was built in the 1950s. Most of our armored force has not really been significantly upgraded in a significant way since the 1980s. And a lot of that's because the people we've been fighting have been armed with technology from the 50s and 40s.
What should the United States be investing in?
We need to be prepared for conventional war. We've decommissioned so much of our conventional army. We have decommissioned most of our armored divisions. As far as I know, to my knowledge, there's only one remaining armored division. In the event of a war with Russia, we cannot utilize just simply a handful of special forces or hope that our aged B-52 fleet or our aged aircraft carriers or few tanks will match up to the sheer volume of armored vehicles they have. You can have the best technology in the world. If you can't manufacture enough of it, you're going to lose. During World War II, the Germans had by far and away some of the best technology of the war. Their Tiger tanks were unstoppable. The problem is they couldn't manufacture enough of them. The Germans developed the first jet in military history. A lot of people don't know that, but they developed the first jet in military history. The problem is again, they couldn't manufacture enough of them. We have to realize that from a military perspective, we need to invest in our conventional force, whether it's high mobility wheeled vehicles for the purpose of transporting troops, much in the same way the special forces originally liked using the Humvee, high mobility all-terrain vehicles, or whether we're talking about investing in new tanks, or whether we're talking about investing in newer Bradley fighting vehicles or newer bombers, hypersonic bombers, or whether we're talking about getting away from the aircraft carrier and moving towards the submarine like the Chinese and the Russians are doing. The conventional battlefield is changing, and we are finding ourselves falling way behind it.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about China's growing influence around the world, especially in the economic, international economic area. And we've also been talking about the antiquated U.S. military and what steps might be taken to make it more competitive with our rivals. Marshawn, I'd like to turn to Afghanistan. Six U.S. soldiers were recently killed outside Bagram Air Force Base north of Kabul. This brings to 16 the total U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan this year. There are presently 9,800 U.S. troops in Afghanistan out of a NATO force of 13,000. What would you say is the state of the war in Afghanistan, Marshawn?
I can't be optimistic about it, unfortunately. It is not a war that we're winning. It is one that we're slowly losing. And it's kind of like if you had a patient with a terminal illness and you're barely keeping him to life. Eventually, he's going to die. You're just kind of putting off the inevitable. The Taliban is wresting control of Helmand province from the Afghan government. In fact, the governor of Helmand had to resort to Facebook to notify the president of Afghanistan saying, I'm losing control of Helmand and nobody's telling you. They lost 90 Afghan soldiers in 2 days of fighting. And the Afghan governor of Helmand said that all that's still in control of the Afghan army are their operating bases. That's it. The rest of Helmand province, which is in the south of Afghanistan, that's Taliban heartland, is now under the control of the Taliban. And then you have regions like Kunduz, which the city of Kunduz was taken by the Taliban. It was taken back a couple of days later. But the Taliban still control everything around Kunduz. And then you have Nangarhar province near Jalalabad, which is now falling under the control of ISIS factions. So it's very clear that as we pull back more and more, the Afghan government is losing more and more. The strategy that we have seems only to prolong the inevitable collapse of the Afghan government. There isn't going to be a pushback of the Taliban unless there's a drastic change in U.S. strategy.
Yes, and as we've withdrawn from Afghanistan and as the Taliban has gained ground, the United States has turned more and more towards paramilitary groups composed of Afghan fighters. There was recently in the Washington Post an excellent investigative report concerning a force called the Cost Protection Force. This is a paramilitary force composed of thousands of Afghan fighters, which operates in the eastern part of the country. It's directed by the Central Intelligence Agency, and it assists the U.S. military by attacking suspected Afghan rebels. Operating outside the normal chain of command and outside the control of the U.S. military, the force has been implicated in civilian killings, torture, and kidnappings, according to this Washington Post investigative report. Marshawn, what do you think of our reliance on groups like this?
The idea of using local paramilitaries, trained local paramilitaries to hunt down guerrillas, is something we did in Nicaragua. It's something we did in El Salvador. It's something that was done in Honduras and Guatemala. The purpose of these death squads, coincidentally, they were trained at the School of the Americas by U.S. operatives to go back and fight the communists. And their strategy was they would go through villages and they would find out if the villagers had any communist connections. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. They just shoot everybody in the village. What we saw from this strategy is it didn't work. Not only did it alienate the population, but it also was not effective in hunting down the guerrillas, because the first thing that this turned into was propaganda for the guerrillas. When our so-called allies in a place like El Salvador would go in and wipe out a village, it would be taken by the left-wingers to immediately vilify the pro-American element. So as a strategy, it doesn't work.
Well, you had the murder of Archbishop Romero.
These are elements either trained by the CIA or trained by special forces, but we have no control over. We can really see this exemplified by the murder of Archbishop Romero in El Salvador. Now, the paramilitaries that killed him, they were trained in the School of the Americas. They were trained by U.S. Special Forces and CIA. But the problem when you train these local paramilitaries is we have no command and control over them. There was no CIA handler there to say, hey, don't do this. There was no Special Forces commander to say, no, this is a terrible idea. Instead, some local commander that we trained goes and decides, because he doesn't like Archbishop Romero, he's going to kill him. As a result, again, this backfires on us tremendously because it makes us hated. It makes us a pariah because our so-called surrogates, who might as well be in American uniforms as far as locals are concerned, because it doesn't matter whether it's American soldiers doing it or whether it's local guerrillas that we trained. As far as the locals are concerned, these guerrillas that are going through and terrorizing their villages are Americans because we trained them. And so as a strategy, it doesn't work because it just vilifies anybody who's not, anybody who is pro-American. It vilifies anybody who is pro-American, and it automatically empowers, in those days, in the 80s, it empowered the left-wingers. And today, what you're seeing in a place like Cost is that these guys go through and they murder civilians, they torture. Well, what's going to happen? How do we know the people they're catching are actual Taliban and it's not, well, listen, Mustafa pushed his fence over 6 feet into my yard, so you know what? I'm going to report him as being a Taliban supporter. He's going to get tortured and shot by the Cost Protection Force. We don't know, but the fact is that when you start doing this, when there is very little intelligence being gathered on the ground, you're empowering local paramilitaries that you have no control over, you end up in the end empowering your enemy, because that's what this does, is it empowers the Taliban. And we saw this similar things happen in Iraq when we started doling out money to these paramilitaries. Sure, the Sons of Iraq, as they were called, were very useful because we got them to see things our way, at least for a little while. We paid them enough that they fought against Al-Qaeda and they helped defeat Al-Qaeda. But the problem is we gave a lot of guns to people who hated Shia. So then what'd they do? They went and started murdering Shia. Well, automatically, again, this empowered Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army, which was the major Shiite opposition group in Iraq. It empowered them to fight against the Americans. So we see that this is a consistent strategy that does not work. In the end, what we're trying to do through this strategy is substitute American boots on the ground. And as we can see, it does not work.
Well, didn't the British have a different approach to using foreign nationals in their military?
British-style colonialism worked. It was much more successful. In fact, we can see that it was even more successful than French-style colonialism and the Belgians, and certainly more successful in their occupations than we, the United States, have. Part of that is because the Brits had a very far-sighted view. The United States right now, we look between presidents, and the policy changes with each president, and even changes with each Congress. We really can't look ahead any further than each Congress, because every 2 years, something's bound to change. And so, you know, we really don't have that far-sighted vision. The Brits did. The Brits, when they brought India under direct rule after the Sepoy Mutiny in the 1830s, and Britain brought India under direct British rule, what we saw was that Britain planned on staying in India pretty much forever. And so one of the things they did is they incorporated Indians into the British Army. Now, they didn't tell the Sikhs, listen, you must shave your beards. They didn't tell the Muslims, you must shave your beards, you must take off your turbans, things like that. What they did instead is they created Sikh regiments. They created Muslim regiments. They created Gurkha regiments from Nepal, and they gave them their own special uniforms. They fought under the British flag, under the Union Jack. They had British officers, but it empowered them because they felt now they were British. It wasn't that, oh, well, you're a Hindi or you're a Gujarati or you're a, you know, a Sikh or this or that or a Punjabi. No, you are British. You are a British soldier. There was dignity in that, as opposed to what we do today, where we show up in places like Afghanistan and we say to warlords, here's a bunch of uniforms, go train an army, or Iraq, where we give this corrupt government a bunch of uniforms and say, here, train an army. It doesn't, you know, we're going to train a bunch of your soldiers. No, this empowered the locals and made them feel British. And you saw that in Kenya. You saw that in South Africa. You saw that in India. You saw that in, and I know a lot of people are hesitant at the idea of, let's say, putting locals in, you know, American uniforms, creating, let's say, an Iraqi regiment in the American, you know, an American-Iraqi regiment kind of a thing. But it worked for the British. Now, granted, we'd have to turn Iraq into a colony. But if that's what we're planning on doing, that works. It worked for Britain. They had the Arab Legion during World War II who fought valiantly against the Germans in the Middle East, a theater of operations that people know very little about, yet they were crucial in cutting off German access to oil, was the Arab Legion. And again, they were Arabs fighting under the Union Jack led by British officers. But there was a dignity to it, and there was also a pride. They didn't have problems with Indian soldiers or Arab soldiers or African soldiers going in and killing their counterparts because there was a pride in being a British soldier. And the other thing too that the Brits were very successful at is they also, when they went into these countries, there was the idea that they're here to stay, Britain's going to be here forever, but also in return, Britain's going to give you something back. Everywhere that Britain occupied, the former colonies try everything they can to emulate Britain, whether it's in their military or their politics or their economy, they seek to emulate Britain. And we could do the same thing. We could get these countries to emulate us by, on the one hand, giving something back. Now, again, I'm not saying the Brits were altruistic either, because they weren't. They took the natural resources. They got their own from these countries. But it seemed like a fair trade. And at the end of the day, these countries prospered fairly well. And again, I know this isn't trendy to say because, you know, colonialism is supposed to be bad, but the fact is it certainly was a lot more effective than what we're doing right now in places like Iraq or in places like Afghanistan, where we just install some government and hope that everything goes well. You need a long-term vision, and that's what the Brits had.
Another U.S. practice is to use our special forces as opposed to regular troops in our foreign military operations. For example, the U.S. is now deploying what it calls a special expeditionary force of special forces to Iraq to fight ISIS. And it is acknowledged, the United States has acknowledged that it now has 50 special forces troops already in Syria. And it appears that in both countries, the U.S. forces will be fighting in the Northern Front alongside the Kurds. Could you talk about the use of special forces and whether they need to be supplemented or complemented by regular troops?
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to say first and foremost, I admire and love our special forces. We have the best special forces in the world, and I'm very proud as an American to say that. The problem is that we have is that we tend to misuse our special forces. Special forces, throughout history, their main role has been to train guerrilla forces, conduct acts of sabotage, gather intelligence, and assassination. And really, the beginning of special forces was in World War II with the British commandos and the US OSS operatives. Now, the job of the OSS and the job of the British commandos was to harass the Germans, train Dutch, French, Belgian, train local guerrillas to harass the Germans, and then, of course, most importantly, to gather intelligence and, of course, assassinate German officers. This was all designed to set the Germans into chaos, to weaken them, but in preparation for the ground assault that occurred on D-Day. If we were to have just utilized the commandos and the OSS behind German lines, would it have drained them? It would have run them down a bit, but it wouldn't have liberated Europe. At the end of the day, it still required the landings at Normandy. It still required 500,000 troops sweeping across Europe. It still required boots on the ground. It doesn't mean that the commandos didn't do their job. It doesn't mean the OSS didn't do their job. These guys were some of the best and brightest in the world. But the fact is that you cannot win with that alone.
As an example, what about the Russians and their use of combined forces in Chechnya?
there are a lot of instances where the special forces are properly utilized. You see that with the Russians in Chechnya. You see that with the Israelis. The Russians utilize their special forces to gather intelligence and mainly to conduct assassination. What they will do is they will locate a terrorist leader and they will seek out and assassinate him. But that is also coupled with intense ground operations. Now, when we look at the first Chechen war and the second Chechen war, particularly the second Chechen war, which was far more successful, the first Chechen war, you had a broken down old Soviet army, the new Russian Federation army, which got bloodied really badly in Chechnya. But in the second Chechen war, you had a combined operation of special forces seeking out and killing the leaders of the Chechen resistance movement, conducting intelligence, but then also wearing them down by funneling the rebels. They would set up ambushes to funnel the rebels into an area, and then the Russians would fly in with helicopter troops. The Russians have pioneered the use of air assault troops, as we call them, helicopter-borne soldiers. So they would funnel the rebels into an area, then they would fly in the helicopters, and the helicopters would cut off the rebels' area of retreat. They would ambush them. And now these helicopter troops were supported by special forces. This wouldn't have been possible without special forces, but at the end of the day, it still required those intense boots on the ground. We see the same thing utilized by the Israelis. The Israelis utilize their special forces, some of the best in the world, to conduct assassinations, to conduct intelligence gathering, and to root out the hotbeds of terrorist activity, to figure out where these are, but so the conventional forces can strike at them. And the same way also they utilize very heavily special forces for hostage rescue. That's another thing that the Russians also do. And that's another thing our special forces are phenomenal at, is hostage rescue. What we're trying to do is we're trying to fight a war Call of Duty style. We're trying to utilize a handful of special forces to wipe out this much larger entity. And granted, that works in Call of Duty. But at the end of the day, a special forces group is not going to be able to take Raqqa by themselves. Special forces can gather the intelligence. They can assassinate the ISIS leaders. They can rescue American hostages. And they can harass ISIS and train local forces. But they have to be supported with boots on the ground. We cannot expect that special forces alone is going to defeat ISIS. And that's where I say the Israeli model and the Russian model are the models to follow.
Well, I'd like to also turn with respect to the war on ISIS to the Germans, because the U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter recently sent a letter to Germany for more troops to help in the fight against ISIS. Now, the Germans are already planning on deploying 6 recon jets, a frigate, and up to 1,200 troops to support a French aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean fighting ISIS from the air. In the last 2 years, Germany has shown more willingness to deploy its forces abroad, and there are now 3,000 German troops serving in wars abroad, and the German Defense Ministry would like to send 650 troops more to support the French army fighting Islamists in Mali. And in addition to that, the Defense Minister of Germany said that Germany might need a bigger armed forces to cope with its more assertive role. So, Marchand, is Germany finally evolving into a more active role in global wars?
Absolutely. We are seeing a change in German policy from what was during the Cold War and the post-World War II era. Germany is really coming into its own. Germany's emerging as a world power, and part of it's because of the necessity of the very violent world that Germany exists in. Part of it is because, for us, antagonizing the Russians in Ukraine is something that happens way over there. For Germany, it's right on their border. They're separated from Russia by only Ukraine and Poland. This presents them with the best excuse to build up their military. In the same vein, also, Germany's always had ambitions of global influence. Germany was only stifled in its rise to global influence because of World War I. Germany obtained colonies in East and West Africa, but they never expanded much further because then they lost the First World War. But still, Germany's always sought to export its influence. And by supporting the French in Mali, supporting the French and the Russians in Syria, and the United States in Syria and Iraq, it provides Germany with an excuse to expand its military and to begin reaching out to become a global military power. Because Germany is not going to be content as sort of a junior partner of the United States, especially in light of what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Germans have fought and shed their blood supporting NATO, particularly in Afghanistan. The Germans have fought and died to support the U.S. effort. Now the U.S. is disengaging and Afghanistan slowly dying an agonizing death. And the Germans are looking at saying, we shed our blood and our money for our U.S. allies, and now they're just walking away. And now not only are they walking away, but they're leaving us with a bigger mess in Syria and Iraq. This is presenting the Germans with an opportunity to develop their own independent military policy.
Excuse me, Marshawn, if you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And I'd like to remind you that the In Context Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to one. And to download a copy of this show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com. In addition to Germany, France is asserting itself more, Marchand. We see, of course, they are now conducting an aerial bombardment from an aircraft carrier against ISIS in Syria. Additionally, they, French, have been very positive in seeking to cooperate with the Russians in their military efforts in Syria on behalf of the Assad government against ISIS. And this is in sharp contrast to the United States, which feels threatened by Russia's military involvement in Syria. Does this indicate that the Europeans are, while on our side, are pursuing a somewhat independent foreign policy?
Well, exactly. And I think a lot of this has to do with the withdrawal we've had from Iraq and Afghanistan. I think has forced the Europeans to a much more independent policy because they're seeing if we follow the American policy blindly, A, the American policy is fickle. It changes between presidents and changes between Congresses. This also means that their own policy is not guaranteed of success. So if they follow an independent policy, it makes them independent of whatever our particular foibles are, whatever our fleeting changes in interests are, or our changes in priorities. For the Europeans, things like Iraq, Afghanistan, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, these are all things that are not that far away. Whereas for us, because they're an ocean away, our policies and our interests and our priorities change not just between presidents, but between Congresses. So very literally, in a two-year time span, our priorities could completely shift. And for the Europeans, this, as we can see from the Paris attacks, in their mind's eye, this isn't enough to base their political and military priorities on. Now, if we offered a much more consistent foreign policy and a much more consistent set of interests, I think the Europeans would still follow in lockstep with us. But the fact is that they see our opinions and our perspectives constantly changing. I mean, 2 years ago, we were talking about bombing Syria to get rid of Assad. Now we're going to be lucky if we keep Assad in power so that we can defeat ISIS. This is just really in a two-year time span. Our policies are fleeting, whereas the Europeans need, for the sake of their own security, something more consistent. So that's why I think you're starting to see them separate themselves from our policy. And that's why you see a different policy towards Russia, because they know that Russia becomes more aggressive in Europe. It might not affect us directly. It will affect them directly. So that's why we are seeing. And again, in terms of combating ISIS, they are willing to cooperate with the Russians because they've already paid the price for letting ISIS sit there far too long. I think that's why we're starting to see a more independent European policy.
And now with respect to additional support for the war against ISIS, Saudi Arabia recently announced it has formed a 32-nation coalition to fight terrorism. Its plan is short on details. Is this public relations or is there anything to this?
I think a little column A, a little column B, as it were, because on the one hand, it is public relations. It's, you know, Saudi is taking a stand. On the other hand, though, what we are seeing is more of an anti-Shia coalition rather than an anti-ISIS coalition. The Saudi government said explicitly this will be a Sunni-only coalition. The Shiites, along with the Christians and the Yazidis, have borne the brunt of ISIS violence. More Shia and Yazidis and Christians have died than, of course, Sunnis. But yet the Saudis want to prevent the Shia from being involved. And I think a lot of this has to do with what the Saudis are looking towards, is that when ISIS collapses, they'll step in the very end, and they'll almost eclipse ISIS, and they'll become the dominant force. They will step in after we've crushed ISIS to then create, if you will, a new Saudi state, but a Saudi state that encompasses all of the Sunni lands. You have to remember, this has been the ambition of the Saudi royal family since the beginning, since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The Arabs have sought, and particularly the Sunnis have sought, a united Arab republic. And I think the King of Saudi is looking at it, and he's looking at a united Sunni state, of course, under his leadership. After ISIS is crushed, he will step in, and it'll be a way to sort of force out the Shia and to marginalize the Shia and push them out and basically oppose Iran, I think is what this is predominantly about. You have to remember also that the countries involved in the Sunni coalition, so-called, have been countries that have given money to ISIS. I mean, let's face it, Saudi Arabia has given money to ISIS, whether directly or indirectly, the Saudi royal family has. Qatar Kuwait, these royal families, the UAE, these royal families have all given money to Wahhabi extremists to pursue their own anti-Shia agenda. So it works out for them. If ISIS wipes out the Shia and then ISIS just cracks and crumbles, then the Saudis and their 32-country Sunni coalition can later on step in and occupy the once Shiite lands. And I think that's exactly what Saudi's hoping to gain from this 32-country coalition.
Well, now, last month, the Turks shot down a Russian plane attacking ISIS in Syria, claiming that the Russian plane had violated Turkish airspace. Now, March, the conflict between Russia and Turkey is not just the product of this recent event. Indeed, it goes back centuries. And I thought it'd be instructive to our audience to talk a little bit about it. Turkey, which is obviously a Muslim country, is composed of ethnic Turks who originally came from Asia. And it occupies what was once the heart of the ancient Byzantine Empire, the European-dominated Orthodox Christian eastern half of the Roman Empire. Well, now, the Western Roman Empire collapsed in the 5th century AD. The eastern half survived for almost 1,000 more years until 1453, when the Byzantine capital, Constantinople, now called Istanbul, fell to the Turks. Marshan, could you please talk about Russia's ancient ties to the Byzantines and how it influences their outlook and their policy towards this region today?
What's very crucial when you look at the tie of the Russians to the Byzantines is first you have to look at religion. The Russians came into the Orthodox Church because Prince Vladimir, the Prince of the Rus, the leader of the what was ethnic Russians of the time, was looking for a religion to unite his people. And he was also looking for a written language too. What's interesting is that he brought religious scholars from all over the world, Buddhist, Muslim, Jewish, and of course, Catholic and Eastern Orthodox scholars. He decided, looking at particularly also at the precarious Byzantine Empire, decided to baptize his nation into the Eastern Orthodox Church. And it was actually in Crimea that he baptized his nation into the Eastern Orthodox Church. And then it was also through the Eastern Orthodox Church that they obtained their written language, Cyrillic, named for a Eastern Christian monk, Cyril, who actually developed the written language for the Slavic peoples, incorporating Greek letters and new letters, of course, to make up for sounds that didn't exist in the Greek alphabet. And you have to remember, of course, the Eastern Roman Empire was a Hellenic empire. It was culturally Greek, as opposed to the Western Empire, which was culturally Latin. The Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, was culturally Greek. So they imparted this Greek alphabet to the Russian people. So they obtained their written language from the Byzantines, they obtained their religion from the Byzantines, and then, of course, they are the descendants of the Byzantine Empire, because Tsar Ivan, one of the many Ivans, married the daughter of the last Roman emperor, the last emperor of the Byzantine Empire before it fell to the Ottomans, the Ottoman Turks. So this meant that Russia also inherited, ipso facto, inherited the Roman Empire.
Actually, I think it was the niece of the last Byzantine emperor, but it tied them, the families, really close together.
Exactly. I'm sorry. You are right. It was the niece, but it tied them together, but also that made his descendants the last descendants of that bloodline, because the bloodline was wiped out when the last emperor, Byzantine emperor, was killed.
So this is going back to the 15th century. From their point of view, the Russian point of view, the light goes out in Constantinople. The light of the ancient Roman Empire, the Christian ancient Roman Empire, goes out there, but it continues to shine in Russia.
And let's not forget also, the leader of the Russian state took on the term Tsar. Tsar in Russian means Caesar. And this is very important because basically the Russian emperor was giving himself the title, not emperor, not king, but Tsar, Caesar. He was taking the title of the Byzantine emperor because the Byzantine emperor was referred to as Caesar. Like you said, that's a perfect analogy. The light is extinguished in Constantinople. It is ignited in Russia. And that is really the close, constant tie that of Russia as the inheritor of the Roman Empire, the new Rome.
Following the collapse of the Byzantine Empire, Russia was frequently at odds with the Turks, and who were, of course, running the Ottoman Empire. And they had no less than a dozen wars from the 16th century to the 20th century. And Russia's objective in these wars was twofold. One, to protect Orthodox Christians in the Ottoman Empire. And secondly, to gain access to the Black Sea with its warm year-round ports. And in the Crimean War, for example, which is a very important war, this took place in from 1853 to 1856, the British fought on the Turkish side because they wanted to end Russian access to the Black Sea and prevent Russian influence from growing in the Eastern Mediterranean. And Eastern Europe largely owes its independence from the Turks, from the Ottoman Empire, because of a Russian involvement, Russian confrontation with the Turks in wars such as the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-1878. So Russia's always pushing south, and the Europeans in that time, the British, were very anxious to keep the Russians from getting any further south.
You know, we tend to, when we look at Russia, we tend to try to put it in an American context. You have to look at Russia from a Russian context. At this time in Russian history, at this time in world history, I should say, you had the great game, the scramble for Africa, the scramble for Central Asia, the scramble for Asia, the Far East. But in Russia, they weren't concerned with colonies in Africa. They didn't want Kenya. They didn't want South Africa. They didn't want, you know, Namibia or the Congo. Wealth and resources, they didn't want that. They wanted to control the countries on their border because for Russia, invasion didn't come from the Congo. Invasion came from their borders. They have always wanted a buffer zone. Now, the Russians have viewed themselves as the defenders of the Slavic people, number one, and number two, as the defenders of Eastern Christianity, and number three, also keeping all their enemies at bay as far away from the Russian border as possible has always been their objective. That's why at the end of World War II, Stalin, who actually wasn't Russian, he was a Georgian, seized so much of Eastern Europe because his goal was never again would a country be able to invade Russia. And that's the same reason why Russia always consistently seemed to fight Turkey. Ever since the fall of the Byzantine Empire, really for such a consistent period as 500 years, the Russians have fought the Turks. And the reason is because Turkey has been that sort of threat, that southern threat to Russia, the gateway for invaders coming up through the Baltics, coming up through the Caspian Sea, denying them access to the warm water port, coming up through the Crimea. This has been the potential access point for invaders. That's also why Russia has always sought to exert influence over Persia and why Russia sought to exert influence over Afghanistan is because of a paranoia of invasion. And that is what shapes the Russian mindset to this day, is that fear of invasion. That's why Turkey is a country that they will consistently be hostile towards.
President Putin recently had his year-end news conference, during which he said he welcomed the Secretary of State Kerry's efforts to negotiate a peace deal in Syria. Since the U.S. is adamant about removing the Syrian President Assad from power, does this mean that Russia feels that Assad is expendable?
Far from it. I think that Russia realistically knows we cannot dislodge Assad, and we're not going to. Putin's pragmatic enough to always negotiate from a position of strength. If he can't negotiate from a position of strength, he's going to make it look like he's in a position of strength. In the case of Assad, he is in a position of strength, because what are we going to do at the end of the day? He's guarded by Russian Spetsnaz. Are we going to go into Damascus? And because we know the Russians have Spetsnaz in Damascus, they're in Latakia. We know that there have been Russian SOBR counterterrorism units in Syria since last year. Are we going to go kill Russians to dislodge Assad? No. And Putin knows this. Putin knows he's in a position of strength. Putin knows if we don't get a negotiated deal, Russia will win in Syria. Because slowly but surely, the Russian army and Assad's army are pushing ISIS. They're pushing the rebels out of the picture. And if we don't negotiate a deal, we'll lose everything. And Russia will control all of Syria, and Assad will be stronger than ever.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott, our military affairs commentator. We began the show by reviewing China's growing economic influence around the world, and we've continued by talking about the U.S.'s strategy in the war against ISIS, about the potential involvement or widening involvement of countries like Germany and France, about the prospects of the involvement of a Saudi Arabian-led coalition. And now more recently we've been focusing on Russia's dispute with Turkey, with Russia's overall long-term historical interests in the region, and finally with Russia's attitude towards the United States with respect to involvement in Syria. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about the most recent Republican presidential debate, which occurred on December 15th, since it was dominated by discussion of the war on ISIS. And some of the Republican candidates made rather interesting statements. For example, Ted Cruz, who in some polls is running second to Donald Trump, suggested that the U.S. carpet bomb ISIS positions. He said, after all, we carpet bombed Iraq in the 2003 invasion. And he added, one could avoid civilians in carpet bombing. What do you think of Ted Cruz's proposal regarding carpet bombing?
Yes, in 2003, we conducted heavy bombing. I wouldn't call it carpet bombing. Carpet bombing was what was done to Dresden in World War II. Carpet bombing is what the Japanese did to Nanking. Carpet bombing is what the Germans did to London. That's not really carpet bombing. That's not what we did in 2003 were precision strikes.
So what is carpet bombing? Is sort of indiscriminate bombing of an area to sort of saturate it?
The best example would be Dresden, where we've absolutely flattened the city to try to break the back of the German people to fight, to break the will of the German people to fight. It is when you go in and your bombers literally carpet the city in bombs. You reduce it to nothing but rubble. It is indiscriminate. It's not targeted. And carpet bombing was something that by and large was moved away from because it was considered highly ineffective. Carpet bombing was used in the Iron Triangle in Vietnam, which the Viet Cong just went underground. So it killed a lot of forest and a lot of animals, I'm sure, but not a whole lot of Viet Cong. Carpet bombing has been considered not only indiscriminate, but also ineffective. The main weapon of war is targeted airstrikes. Targeted airstrikes to support ground attacks. That is what the Israelis proved in the Six-Day War. That's what we proved in the 1991 Gulf War. And that's what we proved in 2003. Again, we dropped a lot of bombs, shock and awe, but it wasn't indiscriminate. We didn't just go in and carpet Baghdad with bombs. Every strike targeted something of military or strategic significance.
And there was also the question about civilian casualties. Doesn't seem to me reasonable from what you said that carpet bombing could somehow be consistent with avoiding civilian casualties.
If you're trying to avoid civilian casualties, flattening a city doesn't work like that. But also, and this is where I get into his lack of understanding of our contemporary operating environment, this is a man who's saying, we'll carpet bomb them like we did in 2003. Well, A, we didn't carpet bomb them in 2003. But B, we're also fighting a different enemy. Unlike in 2003, where Saddam's army wore uniforms, they were in tanks, they were in defensive positions, they were an army. It was a conventional force. What you're talking about with ISIS is you can't really pinpoint ISIS because they all wear civilian clothes. They blend in with the local populace. They are an insurgent army. So you can't exactly target an ISIS armored column or hit an ISIS airbase because the moment these airstrikes began, ISIS disappeared into the cities. They hide amongst the women and children. They hide in the hospitals. They hide in the schools. They build their headquarters underneath mosques and whatnot so that we can't see them. Clearly, carpet bombing would not only kill large numbers of civilians, but it also wouldn't defeat ISIS because simply they move out of the city when we carpet bombed it.
Yeah, Marchand, another idea brought up during the debate was by Chris Christie, who said that he would impose a no-fly zone over Syria and that he would shoot down any Russian plane if it violated it. Is this a smart idea?
If you really feel that we are ready to take on the Russians full force with a 400,000 man army against their millions, yeah, sure. I mean, that seems like a brilliant idea.
Rand Paul called it a recipe for World War III.
Unless you are serious that you really want to risk a war with the Russians, you can't just go around shooting down each other's planes. Superpowers don't do that unless they intend on going at loggerheads. If Chris Christie was serious that he is ready to go to war with Russia today, we need to beef up our military. We need to invest in building up our armored brigades. We need to invest in rebuilding and rearming our Air Force. We need to rebuild and rearm our Navy. We need to invest in technology that's going to counter that of the Russians. Instead, from a position where we have shrunk our military to smaller than it was before World War II.
Marshall, there was an interesting disagreement that occurred during the debate, and that was over whether we should remove or overthrow the Syrian government. And Donald Trump, Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz all seemed to disagree with the view of the other candidates and President Obama and Hillary Clinton that it would be necessary to overthrow the Syrian government. Trump, Paul, and Cruz took the view that if we did that, ISIS would take over, and the first job we have is defeat ISIS. And Donald Trump added that when we fight Assad, we're in fact fighting Russia, suggesting that it was a bad idea. Cruz also went on to say it was a mistake to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya, saying that it only brought chaos and Islamic extremism. And this surprised me. Did it surprise you that they would be questioning, anyone of the Republicans would be questioning the overthrow of Assad? I thought that they were probably united on that. And here a Republican questioned the Libyan overthrow of Gaddafi. That surprised me too.
In the case of Donald Trump, it didn't surprise me only because Donald Trump has been an advocate for working hand in glove with the Russians to defeat ISIS. And Donald Trump actually during the debate said something that really struck me, that sometimes we, in essence, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, we have to ally ourselves with people we don't like in order to defeat a common enemy. He actually said, we can deal with Iran and Russia later. We have to deal with ISIS now. We can't go in and fight everyone at the same time. And that was, to me, I think the smartest thing I heard that whole debate. It's true. Prior to World War II, we were really at loggerheads with the Soviets. I mean, we were supporting anti-communist elements. We'd in fact sent troops to fight in the Russian Civil War in the 1920s. And then all of a sudden, World War II erupts. We're now sending arms to the Soviets. We're now fighting really in a lot of ways hand in glove with the Soviets against Nazi Germany and against Japan. Why? Because we knew, Roosevelt knew, and then later on Truman knew, we could not fight the Japanese, the Italians, the Germans, and the Soviets all at the same time. And that's something that Trump sees. And I think when you're looking at what's happened in particularly in Libya in light of the overthrow of Gaddafi, you are seeing the fact that toppling governments, it's not an effective policy. Again, as we mentioned with the Brits and colonialism worked because they came and they stayed for 100 years. You can't just go and knock off somebody's government and hope that they'll be stable.
Trump surprised me, and he's by far the leading candidate in the polls that I've seen in the Republican race. He said that we've spent $4 to $5 trillion to overthrow foreign governments in recent years. I'm not sure where he got that number, but it's a lot of money we've spent. And he said he'd wish the money had been spent at home to rebuild U.S. roads, bridges, and airports. I'm wondering, are the Republican Party, or at least some members of the Republican Party, returning to a more, so we say, America first, nationalist philosophy that prevailed at least up until World War II, as embodied by people like Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr. or Senator Robert Taft? Could this be starting to come back, a policy which says we shouldn't be intervening all over the world, we should be investing at home?
I think to a great extent, I think the hubris of the end of the Cold War is really ended, or it is starting to end. What you're seeing with the Republican candidates especially is more of the Cold War phenomena. In the end, there was no chance that we were going to go at it with the Soviets. A, we both had nukes, but B, yeah, we would poke and prod each other in other parts of the world. But at the same time, we knew we had to strike a balance with the Soviets. When the Soviets went into Hungary, when they went into Czechoslovakia, there was no chance that we were going to send in the U.S. Army to go liberate Prague. It just wasn't going to happen because we knew it wasn't worth a war with the Soviets. Yes, it is an America first policy. We need to invest at home, but it's also a policy of balance. What Truman established was spheres of influence with Stalin, you know, which is what we need right now with the Russians, which is also because the Russians aren't an unknown. We've gone at it with the Russians before, and we know the best way to prevent a war with Russia is to establish spheres of influence. And I think that's what you're starting to see emerge with the Republican candidates is
Eisenhower, a Republican president, did end the war in Korea, and towards the end of his second term, he really was seeking rapprochement with the Russians, who were then led by Nikita Khrushchev, which was only scuttled when the U-2 was shot down. The knee-jerk kind of interventionist Republican leadership that we've seen probably since the Vietnam War was not characteristic of the Republican Party before the Vietnam War. Times change. Maybe the Republican Party will get a little closer to its roots. But I'm afraid go ahead, Marshawn. One last comment before we close.
Okay. I was just going to say that. I think a lot of it is it's out of a necessity because we know, and the Republican Party knows, more so because the Republican Party is so strong in national defense, they know that we cannot afford a war with Russia right now. And the easiest way to avoid it is to establish spheres of influence and a balance. We did this in the Cold War. We can do it again. At the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, do we, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, launch ourselves into a war we are unprepared for, only to face disaster? Or do we focus on building our national defense at home, securing our borders, building up our economy so that if a war does come, we are ready to fight. It's that old adage, and I love these adages, but this old one especially, you never start a fight, but always finish it. We have to be prepared militarily, economically, infrastructure-wise, to finish any fight that comes up, but we must be very careful with anyone we start.
That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at radioforall.org and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.